Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, folks. Welcome to episode 79 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm, of course, joined by Beau, and we have moved on from the 11th century. You'll probably be relieved to know. And Beau wanted to talk about the armistice at the end of World War One. Now, I have to say, World War One is actually, it's kind of a fuzzy thing in my mind, only because it was one of those things we had to do at school, and my God, did they make it boring. It was just black and white pictures of trenches.
Oh, right.
And it was really boring. And I was just, another trench. Oh, more people looking downtrodden. Oh, this looks awful. Why are they making me do it? Like, there was nothing exciting about it to me.
I felt differently. It was always one of those things that fired my imagination.
Really?
Yeah, it was one of those things when I was a kid, a sort of a fairly precocious kid when it came to history. Mm. And it was one of those things that I was always sort of fascinated by. I don't know why. The horror of it, I don't know.
To me, for some reason, I don't know what it was. It was just, it must have been the way it was presented to us in school, because it was profoundly dull to me. And I didn't get into history until I was into my 20s, where things actually, I started discovering things that were actually very interesting, and I found myself drawn into the whole thing. But this I found totally boring. So where do we begin?
Well, it's just quickly saying that. There's one of those things, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like there's certain bits of history I just, like the Chartists, for example, for some reason I just can't get enthusiastic about the Chartist movement. I don't know why, you know, like.
I'm going to go read a book on those and make you do any parts of that with me.
In the 13th century or something. Eventually you'll find something that is
not interesting.
Dull even to a history nerd. But no, World War One, of course, is so massive, isn't it? It's so pivotal. Hmm. I mean, we still, in a very real sense, we're still suffering from the repercussions of it in all sorts of ways. Our modern world is, in all sorts of ways, a reflection of that conflict, isn't it?
It is. I mean, as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate that it is very clearly the sort of collision between the prior imperial world with modern industrialization.
Yeah.
And they were clearly like, okay, what does all this mean? And actually what it means is death on an industrial scale, which people weren't really used to. You know, I mean, things were bad in the Napoleonic War. But that's 4 million people dead across all of Europe and parts of Africa and some parts of the Americas. You know, that's a lot of people, but it was only, 100 years prior to this, you know? And then suddenly it's like, no, we can kill 50,000 men a day, you know? And it's just, you know, that's Napoleon used to, there was a famous quote where he's like, I spend 20,000 lives a month. They can't beat me, you know? And it's like, okay, that sounds like a lot. Now put that on a daily scale and you realize the intensification of everything that industrialization produces.
Yeah. One historian called the summer of 1918, Dante's Inferno, like a type of hell, a hellscape, an Armageddon.
I remember reading an account from I can't remember whose ship it was, but the ship had got lost near the Antarctic And it had arrived at like some British like outpost there. And they were like, oh, okay, so what, you know, what's going on? We've been lost for, you know, a couple of months. How are things in Europe? And the outpost said, well, Europe's gone mad.
And everyone, oh, that's Shackleton.
Is that Shackleton?
South Georgia. Yeah, yeah, Shackleton, yeah. Says, what of the war? What happened? Who won?
Yeah.
And they're like, it's still going on, yeah, years later. The world, Europe's gone mad.
Yeah. And it like the scale of the devastation until World War II, of course, was just unparalleled. And nobody realised how bad things could really get.
There were a couple of sort of forewarnings of it, like the American Civil War and a couple of things in like the Crimea and the Boer War. But it had never, World War One, everything's just ramped up. And during World War One, from 1914 to 1918, they just get more and more efficient at wiping out thousands of men in a matter of minutes sometimes.
So I remember listening to Dan Carlin's podcast on it ages ago. And it was, I mean, Dan Carlin's brilliant, obviously. But it was when it was the sort of first German advance to the towards France, that where the British Imperial Army of like 100,000 men turn up, but they're the only professional soldiers Europe's seen in like 100 years, and so they're just gunning down waves of Germans who are walking arm in arm, like, you know, singing like, you know, 19th century German war songs or something. It's just mowing them down. It's like, this is insane.
Yeah, it's the miracle of the Marne, where the Germans got as far as the Marne River, not too far from Paris. And it was a miracle that we stopped them. The BEF, the British Expeditionary Force. Yeah, Dan Carlin, I might quote from him a couple of times, because his set of podcasts, Blueprint for Armageddon, about World War One, are absolutely superb. A tour de force, I'd say. Also, one thing just to mention is that quite often in wars, not all wars, of course, each one's a different thing, but quite often in big wars, in both the world wars, if you look at when the casualties happened, there's a massive spike at the end. Like, so many people died in 1945, i.e. at the end of World War II. There's just a huge spike.
Really?
Yeah, and it's the same in World War One. Obviously, the various offensives, you see a spike in casualty numbers, but just in general, the last months of World War One was even more bloody, if you can even believe that.
I assume what this is the effect of positioning. So casualties relatively low, and then the big push to the final blow to end the war. So then all the casualties are.
Where both sides realise they're in a position, it's do or die now.
Yeah.
And we've got to throw absolutely everything we've got left at this.
Yeah.
And come what may. Well, Winston Churchill, when he was talking about the Battle of Crecy in the Hundred Years' War, said this line. I just think it's quite interesting. He said, the astounding victory at Crecy ranks with Blenheim, Waterloo, and the final advance in the last summer of the Great War as one of the four supreme achievements of the British Army. So just to put it in some perspective, he ranks it up there with, I mean,
just the other famous victories
that
we've had.
Yeah, one of the supreme achievements, if you want to call it that, because it is a horrific, horrific thing, the actual accounts. As bad as it gets, really. So where this is going to go out, we're actually recording this at the very beginning of November, but this is going to go out just before, or a few days before Armistice Day. So that's what this is sort of in aid of. So I thought we could just talk a little bit about the situation before the huge offensives and counter-offensives of 1918, and take us right up to the 11th of November.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, just to talk a little bit then about what happened in the months or year or so before before 1918, because some people at the time feared that World War One might go on into 1919, if the Germans wanted to get super stubborn, could go on into 1920.
It's not going to be over by Christmas then.
All right, yeah. So that's another thing to say about World War One, is that it hung in the balance right up until, well, the summer of 1918. The Germans could, it's not a massive stretch, it's not crazy to say, the Germans could have potentially still won, or at least punched through to Paris, and then the whole dynamic of things would have been different. I've said it before in a previous epoch, so maybe it was the one about Operation Market Garden, but everyone knew World War II was a foregone conclusion long before it actually finished, like by 1943, really.
Yeah.
Everyone could sort of see.
Well, the Germans are committed on every single front with powers that just have much greater populations and resources than they do. Mm. You know, it's inevitable.
Whereas the Germans do a massive push in 1918, and had it been successful, everything could have been completely different. Yeah. Another thing Churchill said, I don't have the actual quote exactly, but another thing Churchill said in one of his histories about the war was that if the timing of certain things had been just a little bit different, so famously one of the things the Germans did is opened sort of unrestricted submarine warfare in the Atlantic, particularly against American shipping, all that sort of thing. If they'd done that a bit later on, not decided not to do that, things could have been very different. If the Russian Revolution in October 1917 had been a little earlier or later, everything might have looked different. Mm. Because here's the big sort of grand strategic thing to bear in mind, is that where the Germans had essentially won on the Eastern Front against the Russians, the Bolsheviks, as soon as Lenin got in, they gave up.
Yeah.
And there was a Treaty of Brest-Litovsk where they basically gave away nearly a third of the Russian Empire and the best bits to the Germans. If that hadn't happened, or if that happened a few months later, things could have been different. But the Germans get a peace on the Eastern Front and they're able to ship many, many, many divisions over to the Western Front just before the Americans started turning up in force, in massive, massive numbers, with massive, massive amounts of supplies and materiel. So in other words, if the timing of a few different things there had been a little bit different, I mean, matter of weeks different, the Germans might have won World War One. It's not really a massive stretch. I mean, most serious historians or even serious fans of history, you always got to be a bit careful about that sort of thing. What might have happened if this or that had been different? It just didn't, though. Yeah. So it's pure sort of
who speculation. Who knows what would have happened had the Germans been the dominant power on the continent?
Right, yeah. Because you can quite easily get into, well, what if the Germans had made 100 Paris guns rather than one? The Paris gun was the biggest artillery piece at the time that was able to shell Paris from like 120 kilometers away. You ever heard of that? They couldn't They couldn't believe it. Just like theatres or restaurants just suddenly exploding in the middle of Paris. Yeah. No one realised.
You didn't even realise you were being sieged.
Yeah.
But the problem with alternate history scenarios is that they don't exist. And the world is so phenomenally complicated and events occur that you just don't expect. Like, I mean, like the Russian Revolution. Like, you know, did the Tsar when he went into World War One expect to be overthrown? You know, probably not. It's like the world is so complex and things happen with such little predictability sometimes that there's just no point speculating on what might have been unless you've got a really, you know, unless you've got a really clear view of what's going on. You know, you've got to really know everything's going on. So yeah, I'm not. Like, who knows what would have happened had the Germans won World War? Nobody knows.
It's a good point to make that it's an extremely complicated scene we're looking at. I'm trying to paint here to the point where Dan Carlin, the great Dan Carlin himself, said. Called these battles in 1918 immensely complicated. He said it's one of the most complicated things men have ever attempted to do. Dan Carlin also called it the largest battle the world has ever seen, because it's actually a set of battles. The Germans called it the Kaiserschlacht, which is, you know, the Kaiser's battle or the Emperor's battle. So they knew it was a climactic thing. So just to mention, you've got the Battle of Jutland, the biggest, greatest naval engagement of all time. That's in the summer of 1916, which the Allies, the British, the Royal Navy, essentially wins. And we blockade Germany, its northern coastline. Actually, just a small note on that is we didn't stop that blockade until 8 months after the end of the war, which seems a bit punitive to me, but... Anyway, that did happen.
Germany did start a giant continental war. Against being a little bit punitive towards them.
Yeah, or their hand was forced to start it.
Wow.
See the previous epochs with me in Apostolic Majesty if you're interested in that one. There's a set of epochs about that. But anyways, so these battles, these offensives the Germans launch, it's really sort of a 4-5, depending on how you want to count it, 4-5-6 punch combo of battles over the whole summer. Well, starting in March. Going through to August, really. And the Germans did very, very little offensive actions on the Western Front in World War One. I mean, there were some, of course, and there were counter-offensives, but giant sweeping offensives that the Allies did again and again and again. Germans didn't really do that. There's also, of course, the first massive push into Belgium and France in 1914 stopped at the Marne.
Yeah.
And then there's a famous, terrible, terrible offensive around Verdun the Germans did. And that's sort of it.
Mm.
Until we get to 1918, when, as I say, they had many, many more divisions they could take away from the east, send to the west, and the Americans haven't really turned up. So the Germans correctly calculate, this is our moment. If we're going to punch through and end this stalemate, get to Paris, maybe push the Allies out of northern France entirely, this is our time, this is our moment. And so they launched a massive set of sort of five-punch combo set of battles.
Mm.
And so that's what it is. It's all or nothing now. And the numbers involved are huge. Their army was something like 3 million odd men, something in the order of 190 divisions.
This is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It absolutely dwarfs Napoleonic era things.
Yeah. Napoleon takes 500,000 into Russia, and by World War One, there's nothing.
Yeah. Like, so the Battle of Austerlitz, the biggest battle before World War One. Battle of Leipzig, talking about 300 or 1,000 odd guys aside. So 10 times that, easily.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's massive. But this is just a different scale. And, I mean, how long was the line? You know, like, it must have been 100 miles.
Much more than that. It's from the Atlantic coast to Switzerland, essentially. Yeah, all the way through Belgium and northern France, all the way down to Verdun and a bit further east.
That's insane.
So one of the things to mention about that, actually, is a good sort of segue into that, is the thing you have to appreciate, sort of the key tactical thing, is that if you've got long lines like that, it's not a war of movement.
Mm.
It's sort of a static, trench warfare, obviously, everyone knows that. And so when you have that sort of thing, you have to keep your line, your battle line, intact all the way along, because as soon as your battle line sort of breaks, well, then the enemy can go through, can get behind you, can outflank you and get behind you. So if ever there's a massive bulge or a salient or anything in the line, it's a worry, because your line might break. And then, well, it can very, very quickly be the beginning of the end.
And the thing is, it's not like you can really, like, calling in reinforcements to that position of the line, A, weakens the other parts, but B, it's hundreds of miles away. Like, they're you know, 500 miles that way. Okay, we need to get three divisions. They're going to be here in 2 weeks. Like, well, you know,
So quite often, the biggest worry in the minds of the generals is that our line is going to break at a certain point. And it's not that we can't feel it at some point, but we can't feel it immediately. And so we might get like half our army surrounded or something, you know, we'll get flanked and rolled up, get our line rolled up. So a bit like a medieval battle, but just on a vastly more massive scale.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. And it's both on attack and defense. If you're defending and you get pushed back and your line broken, obviously that's one thing. But even if you're attacking and one bit of your attack gets too far forward, well, you've still got a break that the enemy could counter through. And so it's on offense and defense on both sides. So this game of keeping your lines intact. So bearing all that in mind, the grand sort of strategic overview from the German side is to try and make a break between the British and the French armies on the Western Front, because the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, the basically British Army in France and Belgium, we sort of were responsible for the more Western end of this line up to the coast, including defending the line that was in front of all the great channel ports, you know, like Calais and Dunkirk and Boulogne and all that. So the Germans thought if we could get between the two armies, then the French will have to, they'll have to concentrate then on defending Paris, if they even can do that. And the British will be sort of reduced to a pocket around the, maybe a massive pocket, but a pocket around the ports, the channel ports.
Driven into the sea, hopefully.
Right, yeah. Well, that's the idea. Yeah, roll us up entirely into the sea, push us into the sea. So that was their grand plan. And they came very, very close to doing it as well, I must say.
This is a point I've made about Germany over and over. It's not that, like, Germany loses a lot of wars, but that's only because they have to lose those wars because they're too bloody good at what they're doing. Honestly. Like you say, this is not a bad plan at all, and they nearly succeed. You know? And this is constant throughout, like, the history of modern Germany. So they're too scary to let win.
There's an interesting analogy that Hitler used, and Dan Carlin mentions it in his Blueprint for Armageddon, and says, you know, it's Hitler, but he's actually correct on this. The analogy was that Germany had only really had its shield arm on the Western Front the whole time, and its sword arm had been used everywhere else, particularly on the Eastern Front. And now the Eastern Front is, the Russians have given in. That in the spring and summer of 1918, suddenly the German warrior has got both his sword and his shield to fight against the Allies in the West. And well, it's not sort of an unreasonable or incorrect analogy.
No, I mean, it's completely fair.
Right. Okay, so another couple of just very quick things to mention. In 1917, you've got some massive battles, the Third Battle of Ypres, where there's the British get involved in around Passchendaele, obviously very, very muddy and bloody, the classic muddiest of all the battles, which there are many, or nearly all of them. Giant mining operations at the Messines Ridge, Battle of Cambrai, where tanks were used en masse and effectively, kind of for the first time. Tanks have been around for a couple of years, but were sort of very... Yeah. The Germans at first thought, no, that's a fad. That's a silly dead end of a fad sort of a thing.
Why would a giant armoured vehicle with a gun on it be a fad? Why wouldn't that be useful?
It's sort of like a moving pillbox, isn't it?
Right. I remember seeing the pictures of, you know, men, you know, running behind the tank because, of course, it'll shield you from fire. What a useful thing to have on the battlefield. A giant moving armoured box.
Right.
This is just a fact. That's not a fad. This is the way things are going to be done. It's tremendously useful.
That happens again and again in, or not just in war, actually. Like when the telephone internet was first invented, they were like, well, that will never catch on.
Well, do you remember Bill Gates had a famous thing where he's like, you know, no one will ever need more than 16 kilobytes of RAM or something like that. It's like, at the time, that was silly. You know.
So the very, very early, the very earliest tanks in sort of 1915, 1916 weren't all that effective because the designs were so poor.
Yeah.
But the concept of exactly what you say, like this a moving pillbox or something, is
But they could roll
sound.
Over barbed wire defences, you know, without being damaged. People could move up behind them without being shot. And then suddenly you've advanced a lot further than you would have done if you were just over open ground walking on foot. You know?
Yeah, and barbed wire is no problem.
Yeah,
and even if the trench isn't too wide or the tank is physically long enough, they can just sort of go over the top of trench systems and things as well.
Yeah.
So by 1917, at the Battle of Cambrai is the classic one that all the historians say, there you can see they used, because also at first when they started using tanks, they didn't use them in just enough numbers. But at Cambrai they did. And the Germans had woken up and they started building their own versions. The German versions are sort of funny, gigantic things, like a crew of 15 guys.
Really?
Like, it's almost like a small house moving along at like 2 miles an hour.
Yeah.
By 1918, we were pumping out something like 200 tanks a month, which was, that's a lot.
That is a
that's
lot.
That's loads, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. And also by 1918, both sides, the Germans did it first, but we'd caught on, the Allies, I say we, I mean the French as well, and the Americans.
Yeah.
And there was Italian troops even on the Western Front, small numbers of them. There was a big Portuguese detachment on the Western Front at one point. Anyway, the Allies had realised this thing, defence in depth. So instead of just having a very, very heavily defended frontline trench, we'd actually have like 10 miles, sometimes more, sometimes up to 12 miles of trench systems. And the very, very front line wouldn't even be the most heavily defended bit. It's like an elastic band. You allow yourself to come back and you fight the war in the intermediate zone. So that's a massive thing.
This is what the Russians did to the Germans at the end of World War II, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's just, they realised that we just wear them out.
Yeah. You know,
just whittle them down.
Well, World War One on the Western Front, anyway, is your classic example of a war of attrition, isn't it? Just your classic example of it. Terrible thing.
Yeah, it's just the most hideous thing you could imagine, actually.
Yeah.
This is another reason why I was just like, you know what? I'd rather the big set-piece battles. Give me an Agincourt, you know? Like, you know, there's something heroic about that. There's nothing heroic about this. This is just... It's just the industrial murder of men.
Yeah. It's the exact opposite, really, of heroism.
Yeah. There's no one man's action matters. You know, you're just going to get killed.
The hell where youth and laughter go.
Yeah. I remember seeing a picture of a Russian guy from World War One, where you like literally a picture of him in 1914 and then a picture of him in like 1919. And he looks like he's aged 30 years. Like, it's just harrowing. It's like, God.
And the 1,000-yard stare.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like the just wide eyes. And just the like, you know, he's obviously like 15, 16 or something. And then he's only like 20 when he comes back. But like the wrinkles and the sort of depth of his eyes. And it's just like, you can see the weight of it on his face. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, this is just awful.
Because it's also a lot of veterans say from all sorts of wars, it's not just that you see horrors.
Hmm.
It's not just that you might have to shovel up the remains of your friends or whatever. It's that you personally did terrible things.
Yeah.
Like you killed other people. You stabbed them this close, closer than we are right now. There's one example where a guy, it was a German actually, it might have been actually Ernst Jünger, is a very, very famous account of World War One, where he was helping one of his own friends who'd got wounded. And as he's helping him, a gas shell goes off nearby. And his own friend, who had a wounded arm, was putting his gas mask on with his other arm. And Ernst Jünger says, well, I just turned into an animal, just ripped it out of his hand, put it on myself. And had to watch him gurgle and die.
God. See, this...
You know, things like that.
This is what I mean about the difference between, like, the industrial warfare of the 20th century and pre-modern warfare. Like, you don't get reports like that, actually, from, like, you know, ancient or, you know, medieval... I mean, you get a few, I guess, but, like, you know, when the Crusaders arrive at Jerusalem and stuff like that. But it's not reported in that way by the people who went through it. You know, they actively sought out war. You know, they wanted to go to war because it wasn't just, oh, by the way, now you're about to die. And 5 seconds ago, you were totally fine because, you know, there was no random gas canister that arrives. Anything. You know, when the day of battle happens, you're both lined up. It's predictable. You know, they're moving towards you. They're firing arrows, you put up your ship, whatever it is. You know, now you've got to, you know, have a fight with a bunch of guys in hand. Okay, fine. At least it's, you know why it's happening. You know, you can see, okay, no, they're coming at us now. Right, we've got to, you know, so there's this sort of, not a sense of, I mean, agency is one way of putting it, but like, there's a sense of at least understandability about what's happening. But like, if you're there, all right, I'm helping my guy, and then a gas canister arrives, oh God, you know, it's, there's a sort of weird insecurity that modern warfare, I think, and because like, okay, I'm going to go up over this trench, boom, bullet kills you. It's like, you know, like what, you know, that was... It, you know, there's a profound insecurity, and I think it was Dan Cullen again who was describing it, like in an ancient war, like you were actually in danger very little amount of the time. You know, it was only on a very few occasions where you were in actual, real, mortal danger, and then okay, it was very dangerous for a couple of hours on a day, and then afterwards there's a long period of no danger at all, basically. You know, whereas in like the industrial warfare, it's just not like that at all, and it's horrible.
Mm.
Like, it's this like weird sort of gaslighting, you know, of the individual soldier that seems to go on.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Menards' 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details. Save big.